Welcome to An Honorable Profession, a podcast giving America hope since 2018. I'm Ryan Coonerty. Along with Debbie Cox Bolton of The New Deal, I'm lucky enough to be your co-host. An Honorable Profession is a New Deal Leaders podcast. The New Deal is an organization that supports the next generation of American leaders. From attorneys generals, to state senators, to mayors, to school board members, these are the people that are pushing policies and politics that will respond to climate change, rebuild our economy, address racial injustice, and restore our democracy. These are incredibly talented people who have dedicated themselves to public service when their country and their communities needed it the most. Check out newdealleaders.org to see what I'm talking about. Today, I talked with Maine Assistant House Majority Leader Kristen Cloutier. It was a deeply personal conversation. We talked about how caring for her mom and young daughter drove her passion to pass paid family leave. She shared her experience around the shooting in her hometown of Lewiston, the terror she felt, and the subsequent opportunities to reduce gun violence and help hers and other communities recover. Finally, we talked about what keeps her going as she balances work and life and family and legislating. I found her answer to be deeply honest and inspiring. Enjoy. Representative Kristen Cloutier, welcome to An Honorable Profession. It is wonderful to be speaking with you today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
I think let's start with, for all of us at lower latitudes than Maine, what do we need to know about the state of your state and how things are going?
Well, I am pretty fortunate to serve in a state that has a Democratic trifecta. So we are in control of the House, the Senate, and the governor's office, which sounds like it's really great. Although sometimes I think when you don't have a common enemy to unite against, you tend to fight each other sometimes. But overall, I think we've managed to get some really incredible things across the finish line. I'm in my third term right now. So over the past nearly 6 years, working on reproductive rights amendment this session. We just passed paid family medical leave for the state of Maine, which is really, really exciting. And I was really honored and humbled and fortunate to be the lead House sponsor on that piece of legislation. And just really working to figure out the affordable housing shortage and crisis that I think every community in the country is facing. And really just sort of helping Mainers in need. So I feel really good about where we are, really good about where we're going, and hopefully we will hold those trifectas in this next election in November.
Yeah, and I want to get into some of the details because you've been really pushing on tangible programs that help families in fundamental ways. I guess before we get into some of the policies, let's talk about the politics. Maine wasn't always a state that was controlled by a Democratic majority. How do you think you got there? And as we look at an election coming up in 2024, what do you see on the ground in your state?
We came from having the majority in the House and I believe in the Senate, but having a Republican governor, Paul LePage, who was, he refers to himself as Trump before there was Trump. So that's sort of where we came from. And I think that Mainers decided they had kind of had enough of that rhetoric and decided to elect Janet Mills, the first woman governor of Maine. And we're lucky and proud to have her. And I represent Lewiston, which is the community that was recently impacted by a mass shooting. And even before then, I had lived in other places. I'd lived in New York City. I'd gone to school in Boston. And my hometown of Lewiston is a place that really rallies together in a crisis. We had a series of fires back in 2016 where we really came together to help the folks and the survivors of that tragedy. Same thing with the shooting that happened recently. And I think that that just really speaks to the people of Maine more broadly. You know, we really come together. We really care for each other. We really want to care about one another and take care of one another. And so I think the people of Maine recognize that the Democratic Party is the party that really does that. And so I think that is what sort of keeps us going, which is what will keep us getting through this tragedy, which is what will help us move forward. And so I feel good about the upcoming election. I do worry about a little bit about what's happening on the national level and how that's sort of trickling down to state legislatures.
How do you see what's happening nationally trickling down and impacting your state?
So we have in our three major metropolitan areas, I would say, Portland, Lewiston, and Bangor, we have large immigrant, refugee, asylum-seeking populations. And that's not new. You know, that's probably the past 20 years. The conversation around border security has become a talking point for my colleagues across the aisle here in Maine. The governor included in the budget funding for an Office of New Americans, which we've seen folks coming to the state for the past 20 years. We're just now getting around to, you know, creating an Office for New Americans to help them connect with English language acquisition, workforce development. We have a lot of folks who are asylum seekers and who come from backgrounds in law and medicine and engineering who can't actually use their skills or their education when they arrive here because they don't have work permits. And so they're doing volunteer work at organizations. Some of these folks, once they get their work permits, can't transition their credentials. And so they are working in the, you know, manufacturing facility at Walmart with an engineering degree. Or they're a medical professional and could be providing medical care to folks in their own communities in languages that those folks understand when we have a workforce shortage in healthcare. So those are things that this office would be charged with helping to resource. And my colleagues across the aisle just are basically using racist dog whistles to talk about why this office should not exist. And for me, the Republican Party talks about being the party of pro-business. And I don't feel that we are in a space where you can be pro-business and anti-immigrant right now. So it doesn't seem logical. And it certainly is harmful to some of these folks who have been here for 20 years and are Mainers and should be able to access the same opportunities that everybody else is.
Yeah, it just seems critical when you have significant shortages in key areas in your workforce. And you have people who are there who have the skills who want to contribute. Creating a pathway seems to be a win-win, as you say, for society, for business, for the safety net, for public health. What do you see as the prospects for creating that office and then being able to work through some of these issues? Some of them are federal issues that will be challenging to get action on out of Washington.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly can't control federal policies and their jurisdiction over immigration. What we can control is what we do as a state to help support the folks who are already here. A lot of that has to do with funding for housing. And I think that the important thing to remember is that the funding that we've supported through the budget hasn't been limited to just asylum-seeking populations. It has included folks like homeless veterans and people with substance use disorder, low to moderate income Mainers who, you know, when you say the term affordable housing, affordable is really relevant to the population that's looking for housing. And so the affordability index sort of varies across the spectrum. I feel good about the prospect for the Office of New Americans. When you say we're creating an Office of New Americans, it sounds like that is going to have a large number of staff and its own standalone building and all of these things. It's actually two positions in the budget. And it's housed under the governor's Office of Innovation Policy in the Future. So it isn't actually even its own office. It's a sort of sub-office of a department that already exists. And those two folks will have space in that office. So, you know, I don't feel like we're asking for a whole lot. I think we could be asking for more, but this is a starting point. It's something, like I said, that we've needed for the past 20 years. And it just so happens that the majority party is very much in favor of this office. And so I think that we have a pretty good chance of getting it across the finish line finally.
You mentioned housing, and previously I really want to dive into details around paid family leave. But I guess it may be surprising for some of us on the coast that Maine has an affordability challenge. Can you talk about what the challenge is and then the many ways that you've tried to address it for families?
So I think that the problem sort of varies depending upon which part of Maine you represent. So I, like I said, represent Lewiston. We are the second largest city in Maine. We do not have a public homeless shelter. We are, and maybe every state says this, but I don't live in every other state. We are a state that is somewhat obsessed with home rule. And so we allow our municipalities to create a lot of policies around housing and homeless shelters and warming centers and all of those kinds of things. And so because we do that, there's really no standard across the state. I think that during the pandemic, a lot of folks realized that Maine was a pretty special place in terms of quality of life, and that you could live anywhere in the state and easily access both the coastline and the mountains, that folks really value, you know, quality of life here and being able to have jobs that are meaningful, but also balance that with families and work-life balance. And so I think we had a lot of folks who came from out of state who moved here during the pandemic, and that has now created a situation where prices for homes have increased and we have more people looking for those homes. And so availability has decreased. So there's the affordability piece and the availability piece. We are looking at bills. My hometown of Lewiston, even though we don't have a homeless shelter, our city council during the last term, which we had a full transition now, so we have almost an entirely new council with the exception of one counselor, voted to create a moratorium on the creation of a homeless shelter. And so that was sort of off the table for a while. So we had a bill this session that would prohibit municipalities from creating those kinds of moratoriums. And then one of the, I think, foundational things that we were able to pass this session around housing is a Housing First program. So recognizing that housing is really the foundation upon which people are building their lives and upon which they are able to be successful in life. And so really trying to figure out everything from like development to housing vouchers to general assistance to how we're supporting our asylum-seeking population, how we're supporting our unhoused population, really taking a comprehensive look at housing and what we can do, both in terms of monetary resources, but even just adjustments to policy that can help us be more successful. We created this session. We, in the past, have had a labor and housing committee. We also created this session a joint select committee on housing. So those folks are really digging deep into the policy issues around housing specifically and the crisis that we're currently in. And so they've been doing public hearings and work sessions on bills, but they've sort of been holding on to the meatier pieces so that we can build a comprehensive plan as opposed to reporting out these sort of little individual pieces that may or may not tie together in a nice package. Because I think the problem now, again, because it's at crisis level, requires us to do a little bit of a deeper dive than just looking at individual pieces of legislation.
Housing affordability and homeless shelters are obviously essential to making it possible for people to survive, but also being able to have time off to care for loved ones. Can you talk about the effort to create paid family leave and your role in it?
I would love to. So my kind of work around this started as having been a caregiver for my mom who had dementia, had been living in Florida, ended up moving back to Maine and spending some time living between my house and my siblings, and having to serve as an unpaid caregiver for a parent, which basically flips the entire script of what your relationship with your parent is. And so really feeling like we don't really recognize that care. You know, we're still expected to go to work. My mom was coming to work with me. I also have a full-time job in addition to the legislature. She would come to work with me and just sort of sit in a chair in my office while I was doing my work for 8 hours a day because I needed to be at work and we didn't have anywhere for her to go. So became pretty, I think, passionate about the issue and started thinking, you know, more broadly. We had created a grant program for family caregivers that got them $2,000 per year to put towards whether it was respite or whether it was making accommodations to their home when we had ARPA funding. So it was a one-time pilot program. But really started to think about with one of my colleagues in the Senate about how to make that part of our work culture. And again, like work-life balance. And my colleague in the Senate had been working on paid family medical leave for a long time. We were being faced with a ballot referendum in Maine around paid family medical leave. And my experience with ballot referendums is that they are sometimes wildly successful and sometimes not so much. And so really wanted to find a legislative solution to that. And I don't typically pat myself on the back for a lot of things, but we really created a process that has not ever, I think, happened, at least in this legislature, but maybe not in any. Senator Daughtry and I went on like a whirlwind tour of the state, meeting with every chamber of commerce that we could get our hands on, talking to anybody who would listen, individual businesses, individual constituents, to really not just sort of pitch the policy, but to get feedback from folks on if they were to support a program, what they would support, and if they couldn't support a program, why not? Because we really did want to create a policy that would be beneficial to businesses and to individuals who needed to take the time off to care for loved ones themselves or to have a child. The policy we created spans, I would say, a continuum of care. So from when you're having a baby to when you're sick to when you're having to take care of an aging parent. It is probably the most comprehensive, I think, paid family medical leave program that has been created in any of the states that have one at this point. Most of the time, we were very not well liked by our either the folks pushing the ballot referendum or the businesses. We were sort of in our own like middle lane because we were trying to bring all the voices to the table. But I feel like that work, you know, over the 2 years that we did it, really created an extremely strong policy. It gets people 12 weeks off from work at a tiered reimbursement rate. So this is going to get into the weeds around like policy details, but up to the state average weekly wage, which is about $1,100, you get a 90% reimbursement and then a 66% reimbursement on anything above that. The definition of family is fairly broad. So we wanted to make sure that folks who had familial relationships were included. So it doesn't have to be a blood relative, which matches our FMLA law. And then we also wanted to leave it. We have a fair number of businesses here who are already providing their own paid family medical leave policy. And we wanted to make sure that if those policies were equivalent to what the state was offering, that they could maintain those policies so that businesses weren't being forced to go along with a policy that they didn't have to necessarily go along with and have to put in sort of the administrative burden back on those businesses. So I'm really proud of that work. I'm really proud of the policy. One of the things that was shocking to me when I came to the legislature was that the House and the Senate Democratic caucuses, even though we're one team, don't necessarily work together all the time. And so the sort of collaboration that I was able to have with Senator Daughtry over in the Senate and to really, you know, she introduced the bill, but it was really our bill. And there's not a single time, I think, that one of us talks about this piece of legislation where we're not talking about the other person. And so that felt really special. And the stars aligned really at every turn for us. And, you know, I get to feel and see my mom in the policy every day. And so that's been really personally rewarding.
It's always amazing when ends and the means are both good and you end up with something that you know will profoundly impact people's lives in positive ways. I guess you grew up in Lewiston and returned, and you referred to Maine as a magical place. Can you talk a little bit about your life story and what you drew you back to your hometown and to service?
Yeah. So I, like I said, grew up in Lewiston, went to college in Boston, moved to New York City after that, was living in New York City when September 11th happened. And it really ages me, makes me feel older when I talk about this, but the internet was just becoming a thing when I was in college. And when I graduated from college, people my age in my early 20s were making millions of dollars off of IPOs, off stock options, basically from internet businesses. And I don't know if they even still have this anymore, but there was banner advertising on websites and people would buy clicks. So every time somebody clicked on a banner, someone would be paying for that. So I was selling internet advertising in New York when this happened. I look back now and I think about like, I was a pretty shallow person. Like, I'm not really sure like how I ended up where I am. I mean, I will tell you how I ended up where I am, but it's a stark difference from like who I was when I lived in New York to who I am now. September 11th happened. I wasn't able to actually be in contact with my family for about 3 or 4 days after that. And that was scary. So I kind of decided, you know, I was living this really fun life in New York, but wasn't really connected to my family and decided that I wanted to be. And so I ended up moving back in with my mom at 27 years of age, which I don't recommend to anybody. It's a very rough time to move back in with your mom. Ended up getting a job at Bates College, which is a small liberal arts college in Lewiston. It's one of the three major employers there. I got a job then, and I'm still working now in our community partnerships office. And so we connect students with volunteer opportunities and community engaged learning opportunities, which basically allow them to put what they're learning in a classroom into practice with nonprofit organizations. And I would say that 95% of the nonprofit organizations in Lewiston are able to function because of the Bates students they have sort of performing the work. We have students in hundreds of classrooms across the district, really mentoring young folks in our community. So through that work, I've been able to connect really closely with a lot of community members, with a lot of nonprofit organizations. One of the students that we worked with graduated from Bates and served on our city council. He decided he wasn't going to run for that seat again and asked me if I was interested. And at first I was like, no way, that is not anything that I've ever thought about doing. And then after someone asks you, you kind of start thinking, is that something I could do? Is that something I'd be interested in? And I decided to kind of throw caution to the wind, had never run any kind of campaign before, had really not really thought about politics beyond like a single politics course that I took in college. Ran for my seat, won, served on our council for three more terms. Was elected by my peers as city council president for three of those terms, served as the school committee representative for the council for three of those terms. And then someone you all may have heard of, Jared Golden, who is our state congressman, decided he wasn't going to run. He was going to run for Congress. He wasn't going to run for his House seat and got asked, recruited to run for his legislative seat, which is the seat that I have now. So it's been sort of a slow progression. I serve as our assistant House Majority Leader, so the whip this session. I'm running for Speaker next term. And so I have a nice life that I've kind of built around service. So starting out with my work in the Community Engagement Center, moving into the City Council, now in the legislature, it's kind of the service piece is something that I feel like I never knew I needed, and that really, I find, defines a very big part of my life right now.
So you're having tremendous impact at the state. When I look at the bills, you're moving big, meaty pieces of legislation, and you mentioned you have a full-time job plugging in hundreds of college students into nonprofits. How do you manage the competing activities and find the balance that you mentioned earlier that Mainers so value?
So, great question. I have a really flexible employer who sees a lot of value in the work that I do with the legislature and the conversations that I'm able to have with students. So I get to connect students, not just with nonprofits like in our community, but I can bring them to the State House and I can get them to public hearings and to work sessions and allow them the opportunity to connect the policies and the things that they are most interested in on a much more personal level. And that's a piece of the work, the connection of these two things that I really enjoy a lot. The one thing I should also mention is that I have a daughter who has grown up with me doing this work. And is another big reason aside from my mom why I do the work. When she was younger, she, you know, would come to city council meetings with me and sort of sit in the chamber. When I was in the legislature, we have this legislative retirement room. She learned to play cribbage in there with, you know, the representative from Winterport and actually became quite good at it because of some of the lessons that he taught her. And now, you know, she wants nothing to do with me, my work here at the legislature. So it's been sort of like a whole other spectrum of interest on her part. But being able to take her with me to these things, even though I think she would never admit it today, at some point in the future, I think it has been a foundation for who she will be as a human in this world later on. And so I think that that is really important. I think, you know, the balance is always hard. I am here at least 3 days a week right now. The other 2 days, I try to focus on my work at the college. And for a long time, I would spend weekends doing whatever the extracurricular work was for either of those two things. And I really have had to remind myself that it is okay to binge watch Griselda on a on a weekend if that's what I feel like doing. And to really make sure that I really love to cook. And so making sure that I'm doing things like that, that I can also then engage with my family on, right? So I'm maintaining that balance. But I also really, you know, when I'm not doing the legislative work, I kind of crave doing the legislative work. And so in a lot of ways, and I think this is probably true for a lot of people that are serving, it's work, but it's also kind of your hobby. You know, it's like the thing that you love doing, because if you didn't love doing it, there's no reason why you would. You know, like we do not get paid here a lot in Maine. It's considered a part-time legislature, but it's fun. And I love the people that I serve with and work with, and the staff is incredible. And I, you know, this, I'll be going into my last term in November, and I kind of sad to think about like that I won't be there the following term.
Well, let me just say a couple things. One is my dad was mayor when I was in high school. And, you know, at the time I had no appreciation for it, but it's obviously had a lifelong impact, and I'm sure it will on your daughter. And balancing is always hard. For the listeners at home, just had a 9-year-old come in and decide this is the moment, who's homesick today, who decided this is the moment he needed to rustle through the snack drawer right next to me. But I guess share, what is it that even when you're away from it, you love it? Like, what is it about the legislative experience that you recommend to others?
So if you've seen Hamilton, you know the song, The Room Where It Happens.
Yeah.
I just love being in the mix. Like, I love being in the mix. I love knowing what's going on. I love feeling like I'm making a difference. Being in the weeds on things, like, I am a very detail-oriented person. And so being in the weeds on things, I like to know the ins and outs of all the little nuanced pieces. And so when I don't have access to that, it feels like something's missing. It's funny because, you know, I said I served on the city council. I was mayor for a very brief stint of time, about 10 months. And when I first came to the legislature, I was still serving as a city council president. I was still the mayor. I was serving my first term in the legislature. I had an 8-year-old daughter, and my mom was living with us at the time with dementia. So there was a whole lot of stuff going on. When I finally stepped away from the city council and the mayor's piece because my term was up, I felt lazy for the time. Like, I was like, there is kind of this like void in my life that I hadn't yet, like, you know, found a way to fill with the legislative work because it was my first term. And I was like, I'm like, literally, I'm not doing anything right now. And so I think a lot of us just like the work so much that it fills us in a way that, like, to have even just a little bit of space feels vacant.
Wow. I know exactly what you're saying. I also, as you list those things off, I'm tired just hearing, just one of those things makes me tired, but to all of them.
I don't know. I have no idea. Like, people ask me, how did you do that? And I'm like, I don't know. It's just like autopilot, like something kicked in and it was like, just do it. Honestly, I think as women, that's just kind of how life is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's remarkable. Well, I hope your life is full, and as speaker, I hope it isn't that full again. I do want to talk about the shooting in Lewiston. You represent the community. You served as its mayor. It's a small community that was rocked by you know, terrible gun violence, like too many communities are. Can you talk a little bit about the experience and any potential legislation that may have come out of it or may still come out of it?
Yeah. So I was actually at my Bates office the night that it happened, got a call from one of my legislative colleagues whose husband works in law enforcement. And she was like, are you okay? And I was like, why? What are you talking about? She's like, well, we just heard over the scanner that there's been a shooting at, you know, such and such a place. And I was like, I hadn't heard anything. So pretty quickly after that, they put the lockdown in place because we did have a 3-day. The thing that I think differentiates Lewiston from a lot of other mass shootings is that we were in lockdown for 3 days because they couldn't find the shooter. So we were in lockdown. As it turns out, I have the same car as the shooter had. So for me, it was kind of like, I really have to stay at my office because I'm worried that I'm going to be pulled over and taking law enforcement away from where they should actually be because I have a car that's the same. And then, you know, in the days that came after, I think everyone who's been in this situation would describe it the same. It's really fast and furious, and you're just kind of like on all the time because the press inquiries are coming all the time. The constituents are reaching out to you and you're trying to figure out how to navigate what they need. You're really trying to be emotionally present for everyone who needs you to be emotionally present, including your own family. And so again, I think that the adrenaline just kicks in and you're just doing the job. That attention goes away at some point. And I think that has been the harder thing to manage because you're on autopilot in the beginning. And then once it starts to get quiet, that's when you really kind of start, I think, to process what's happening. And I think that that is not just true for folks who are in elected positions, but I think anyone who lives in that community finds that transition, I think, to be difficult. I also serve on the board of an organization called Community Concepts, which is the organization that is holding up our Community Resiliency Center, which is the place where folks can go to get resources and support. And that will be in place, we're hoping, for at least the next year, but maybe well into the future. And so there was sort of the added responsibility that comes with that and sort of knowing what the needs are, maybe better than other folks in the community because we're the ones on the ground providing them. The other thing that has kind of happened, well, so what I will also say is that I was fortunate to attend a New Deal event a week after the shooting happened. And at first I really, you know, struggled with whether or not I should still go. Is this a good decision? And what I will say is that there are a number of New Deal leaders who come from mass casualty communities and who supported me in ways that I didn't know I needed to be supported. And just having those folks to be able to vent to, but to also be able to ask questions and really try to understand if what I was feeling and what I was experiencing was normal was really, really helpful to me. And so I'm really grateful to New Deal for having that convening and that I, you know, made the decision to still go because that was really, I think, important for me to help with the processing. The other thing that kind of has happened is the legislation sort of takes place on a state level, right? And so a lot of the attention then gets drawn away from the community in which this tragedy happened. When you're talking about gun safety legislation or public health legislation after a mass shooting. But the impact of that shooting remains in that community for years, decades to come. And so I think that there's this sort of careful dance that needs to happen around having the conversations around gun safety at a state level, but also maintaining a focus on the community in which this happened, because they're the community that's going to need to be resourced going forward. And so I think that that's what we're trying to do here in Maine. We've been working really, really hard on putting together comprehensive gun safety legislation, but also public health legislation related to mass shootings. So the governor has a bill, and she talked about this in her State of the State address, that will address background checks, that will build up a network of crisis receiving centers in the state of Maine. The first one, which will be placed in Lewiston, which I think is really important. She's created a continuum of care fund for survivors of the tragedy that will invest funding so that sort of like a college endowment. So you invest $5 million and that spins off about $250 that can be spent annually to support victims and survivors. The crisis receiving centers, the background checks, tightening up some laws around felonies and misdemeanors for gun possession. And then the House and Senate are looking to introduce their own pieces of legislation. So I think that the governor's bill is really a starting point. The House and Senate will have additional pieces that our members really want to see come to fruition. And that will include things like assault weapon bans and magazine capacities. It will also include notifications to gun dealers when somebody, you know, purchases a gun who maybe shouldn't have purchased a gun, or somebody who's looking to purchase a gun who they shouldn't be selling to. So better communications around those things. We're hoping to do something around waiting periods. And so really considering everything across the gun safety gamut, I think, as possible. How many of those things we'll be able to get across the finish line remains to be seen, but the plan is to offer members an ability to vote on as many of those things as they're comfortable voting on. We also think that it's important to address the public health piece of gun safety. And so that includes things like our speaker wants to increase the number of crisis receiving centers that the governor's bill suggests, and really put in some more support around mental health resources for folks. Our senator, our Lewiston senator, Peggy Rotundo, and I have been having multiple conversations with folks who are running the Community Resiliency Center. So that's the one that's run by Community Concepts, to see what funding sources they need to be able to consider that, to run that into the future. What a lot of folks don't understand is that the federal funding that comes to build those things is a reimbursement, and that those reimbursements come 12 to 18 months into the future. So Lewiston is a community that supports two of the lowest income census tracts north of Boston. Our municipal government is not in a place to lay out millions and millions of dollars to be reimbursed 18 months from now. And so figuring out how to fill that gap has been a big lift and a big piece of the work that she and I have been doing. We also have a hospital and a nonprofit organization that provide the bulk of mental health services in both our county, but in several surrounding counties. And as you can imagine, we have a workforce shortage on a good day. We're looking at increased need for those services and not enough providers to provide them. And so really trying to figure out how we can help them out to get through this crisis period, and recognize that trauma often isn't recognized until 10 years from now. And so how do we make sure that we're able to still do that 10 years from now? So there's the immediate legislation that we can turn to, and then there's making sure that we are thinking beyond this session and what the long game is on both of those things.
I'm sorry that you've had to experience that as a community member and then navigating the many challenges that come after, as you say, for decades. I'm glad that New Deal could be a resource. And I think, unfortunately, you will be a resource for future leaders who also experience this until we get some sensible policy at the federal level. I guess just to close out here, I mean, you engage in civic education professionally. You live civic education in the legislature. You live civics. What gives you hope? What keeps you going and engaged both with bring up the next generation of leaders as well as yourself and balancing all these various roles and responsibilities?
As frustrating as it can sometimes be, I feel really fortunate to work with college age students and to do the work that I do with them, actually, because I can see how engaged they are politically, but also sort of where that comes from. Like, it's personal for them. They're not jaded, like I think some of us who are a little bit older can be. It's innocence in a lot of ways. Their hearts drive them. It's not necessarily their heads. And so that can sometimes be frustrating, but it's also, again, the thing that I find really hopeful. And then seeing them share that in a lot of instances for our students who are working in our public school system, seeing them share that interest in not, I don't think it's politics. I think it's an interest in the future that I don't necessarily think high school students think about all that often, because, you know, the world is ending because they're not wearing the right sneakers, right? But to instill in them, I think, this sense that there is something bigger than them and that it matters, and that it matters not just to them, but to their friends and their families and this community that they're living in. And then to see that those college students really dig in Lewiston, which is a community that has a lot of challenges and a lot of opportunities, But to see them dig in a way that makes me think that they will want to stay there for the long term. And I think that that's really what we need, is engaged young people who get it, because we're not going to be here much longer. And so whatever we can do to sort of help build the world that they want to see, I think is a big part of why a lot of us choose to serve in this way. And so I love that I get to be around youth and share in their hope.
I love that. I mean, I love building a world that they want to see. That's a great aspiration for all of us. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for being part of New Deal. As you mentioned, Maine is on the cutting edge of some really good policies that I think can be scaled not only in Maine, but in other states. And you're giving us the model and the path and the inspiration to go forward. And so we're grateful to have you as a New Deal leader.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
An Honorable Profession is a New Deal Leaders podcast. Thanks to the team at New Deal for producing this episode. We encourage you to bring honor to public service, and because we keep things honorable, no tax dollars are used in the making of this podcast.